Y'all, it's me, Dr. Sabina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Sabina Ramon, sexual medicine specialist and menopause expert here in Chicago. And I'm here to remind you that if your body sometimes feels off or dismissed or disconnected, you're not the problem. We know that today, because today we're actually going to have a wonderful conversation about what sits underneath so many of what we see in our patients, but it doesn't get named out loud. And that is really trauma. Trauma is something that is not, you know, it's something people have one way of thinking about, but we see it in so many different ways in our lives, whether it's sexual trauma, medical trauma, you know, childhood trauma. It perpetuates so many people's lives, and it can show up in a variety of ways with sexual activity, with low desire, with not being able to tolerate an exam. Because as it said, the body you will always remember. Today, I'm super excited to talk to Brooke Braylove, who is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist. She's ASEX certified sex therapist with over 20 years of experience. She helps, she specializes in helping high achieving women break free from perfectionism, trauma, emotional patterns that get them stuck in cycles of self-pressure and self-doubt. Her work integrates neuroscience-based approaches, which we're going to talk about because some people haven't heard about accelerated resolution therapy, which we're going to talk about. And she's also trained in the Daring Way based on the research of Brené Brown, helping individuals move through shame into resilience, courage, and self-compassion. I love her work. I love what she's doing. And she's going to give people some real tools today to get to where they need and understand how to find it. So welcome, Brooke. So lovely to have you.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
It's so exciting. I want to start with, you know, I'm gyno girl, so I love a good backstory. So I want to hear what your backstory is. What brought you into the world of, you know, psychotherapy, into sex therapy, all the things. You know, let's hear about it.
Well, what brought me into psychotherapy is actually my own psychotherapy. So I had wonderful parents who were pro-therapy, you know, back in the late 70s, 80s. And so I was a pretty anxious kid. And so the first time I ever went to therapy was, I think, third grade. And I liked it. I liked having someone special to talk to once a week that was just for me. And I really found meaning in it. And at different points in my life, I would go back to therapy, you know, when I needed some more work or a tune-up or through a depression. And so I just loved that special relationship. So for me, being a therapist is really about being able to impact people, you know, one at a time in a very intimate way through relationship, which is really how we learn trust and authenticity and deep connection. And then I became a sex therapist because at the age of 39, I found myself divorced and had an amazing sexual awakening that I felt like everybody should be privy to an experience in their lives. And so I was super fascinated by talking about sex and learning about sex. And it, you know, it frankly is just a lot of fun.
It is. And we met at Ishbosh. I talk about Ishbosh on this podcast all the time, so my listeners know. But, you know, we have the best conferences too. Yeah, it's so interesting to say that you, when, because you said you grew up in the 70s and 80s, and you know, having been in that time period myself, understanding that, you know, having parents that are so, you know, really with it and advanced in some ways, like, you know, the boomer generation wasn't really the ones that were like, let's cater to what's happening to you emotionally. They were just like, deal with it, we'll talk to you later, you know, that kind of thing. So to the fact that you had such support is really amazing. Can you talk a little bit about, like, you know, this, I think that's very unique. Were they in the background of any kind of medical, psycho, or psychological?
No, not at all, actually. But I think my parents were people who thought you should talk to experts when you didn't know something. Okay. And so when they got a divorce, they, you know, talked with a therapist about how to tell us and, you know, the best way and things to do and not to do. And so, again, I'm really grateful. I also grew up in a family where expressing big feelings was totally allowed, especially with my mother. So I was allowed to be in a crappy mood. I was allowed to be sad. I was allowed to cry. And I was met with presence and connection. Mm-hmm. And of course, that is not what I see in my office. I see so many people, adults, who, you know, if especially if they're men who yeah. grew up with boys don't cry, I'll give you something to cry about. And any big feelings, including joy, were squashed. And so what does that mean for their relationships, their intimate relationships? Doesn't mean really good things because they aren't able to express themselves and they don't trust that someone actually cares about their inner world and inner experience. And I was, with a mom who, again, just made so much accepting space for all of that. She wasn't perfect, but she made a lot of space for my big feelings. And I had a lot of them.
I mean, you know, speaking of around like childhood experiences, you know, we had a great session at Ishwish about childhood experiences and some of them adverse and some of them not. We don't want to label all of them, but we do know there's a lot of good data on what adverse childhood experiences do, not only to like, you know, your sex life, but also just like in general, how it manifests in your cardiovascular health and other ways. I think I had heard Sophie Bergeron for the first time from Canada talk about it years ago, and it was really eye-opening. So now I make sure I sort of like really inquire about people when we consider all the different types of trauma they experience or whatever the case may be. But I guess first I want to ask you, like, can you sort of define what you see is trauma? And then let's talk a little bit about childhood, and then we can go into some of the other aspects.
So I define trauma really as anything that happens to you that your nervous system finds overwhelming and has difficulty processing. And so, you know, some people distinguish between big T trauma and little T trauma. You know, that's a little controversial. I use that language only because I think it helps more people accept that they did experience traumas in their life if you don't label it as a big T trauma. Because most people do not come in and maximize their trauma. They right. minimize their trauma.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so my job is to help them see that even though, you know, it wasn't, you know, witnessing war or, you know, murder, that even if they had kind of, you know, a father who got angry every time they spilled a drink, even that a child can experience as traumatic based on what their body does in the moment. And so, again, what I like to think about is that trauma really is anything that overwhelms the nervous system that puts you into fight, flight, freeze, or fawn.
But now I'm like thinking about if I'm putting my kids through.
little T.
Yeah, but I think, you know, to your point, it's so variable in terms of the different types of trauma people experience. There's childhood types of trauma that happen. We know medical trauma is real, obviously sexual trauma, all the things. How do you think adverse childhood experiences kind of show up in adult intimacy?
They show up everywhere. They really do. And again, that can be anything ranging from, you know, growing up in a single parent household to having an alcoholic parent to being, again, the victim of violence or a witness to domestic violence. And all of that creates an environment in where children do not feel safe in their own bodies. It's not, children can't say to themselves, wow, it looks like mom and dad are really struggling and, you know, something's wrong with them. Children are inherently narcissistic. They blame themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you have kids who grow up thinking they're the problem or they're at fault, they cause bad things to happen, I think they walk around with that. and they often experience a great deal of shame. Mm-hmm. And they then deal with that shame in different ways. They might act out. They might, you know, sexually act out or act out violently, or they may go inward into shutdown. And so relationally, that's often what you're going to see, this kind of either coming at you aggressively or shutting down, right? Mm-hmm. So you're either fighting or you're fleeing. And so relationally, that's very, very challenging.
Sure. Yeah. And to your point, I think, and so some of the kids who were exposed to, say, like a lot of even verbal abuse, right? Not necessarily physical abuse. Do you think, and they're both, you know, bad in their own ways. I think, do you find some people then become, you know, is that how we have so many abusers that come from abusive families, that they take that role on because that's what they see, right?
Yes, that's the intergenerational trauma that is so hard to undo. Although mm-hmm. I do see people, you know, changing those generations moving forward. But again, that takes work. Exactly. That absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And it is pretty awesome to be able to provide people support, psychoeducation, and healing that does enable them to see that they can make different choices. But yes, I mean, what we find is if someone grows up in an, you know, let's say a physically and verbally abusive household, mm-hmm. it is very likely that they will either be victims to that again, or they will be perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And the way I like to frame it is usually when someone grows up and parents are violent, they spend their whole lives saying, I am not going to be anything like, you know, my dad. I am not, no matter what, I won't do this to my kids. I won't do this to my kids. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the universe and the brain don't know the difference between mm-hmm. not violent and violent. And so you actually end up creating that kind of propensity inside yourself by disavowing all of that. So what I find is what you can help people to do is say, you know, this happened to me. I might have a little propensity inside of me, and that would make sense. So how do I want to deal with that part that it doesn't become who I am?
Right.
And that is a lot more manageable. And so, you know, whether it's IFS work, internal family systems, looking at different parts of people, there's mm-hmm. a part of me that can be a perpetrator. There's a part of me that was a victim and might become one again. But again, this takes support, consistency, love, and attention. And honestly, sometimes money for therapy. And that's a problem in many communities, of course.
Let me ask you, let's talk a little bit about how physically it manifests, right? So people that are they live with this trauma or they hold this trauma, you're a kid that goes off to college, you know, you've been under an abusive environment. How do they physically, how is it manifesting?
Well, if it doesn't manifest in a really outward way, like drug addiction, you know, sexual acting out, violence. If it doesn't go outward, it goes inward. And that's, of course, what you were alluding to at the beginning of the podcast, which is the body keeps the score. And so then you're looking at things like chronic headaches, GI issues, chronic back pain, migraines.
Pelvic floor dysfunction.
Say it again?
Pelvic floor dysfunction. Yeah,
exactly. And and I have a lot of anecdotes about pelvic floor dysfunction when we talk more and a little bit about a therapy I provide. But mm-hmm. it shows up in the body in gripping patterns, literally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the body learns to guard. Then that creates tension, chronic tension in the body. You know, mm-hmm. TMJ. I mean, you're pointing to your jaw. I'm like, yeah, TMJ. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I say, I see this happening, you know, obviously clinically. I'm wondering, you know, I've been thinking a lot because, you know, we did a session on AI and everything. So I was going to ask you this later, but since we're talking about this, and because I want to talk about how we can deal with some of these traumas, and I want you to talk about some of the therapy that you provide. But tell me where you think like the intersection of the chat boxes is going to come into play. Because I think, you know, for me, I've been thinking, you know, so many people are doing chat boxes, so many people are using AI, and they come to me with these preconceived notions based on what the AIs are telling them, right? And I don't know if you were able to stick around for the talk that I gave on AI and bias, is really like who is creating these systems within the machine learning center, right? Or if I'm a white male that's putting in all the data, like, am I then automating sexism and racism? And that's always the question mark, right? But when it, you know, I had someone recently talk about, you know, how they used AI to better communicate with their clinician, because AI had terms to utilize. And so, you know, she was someone who, you know, maybe might have been, you know, on the spectrum or something like that, and couldn't really. And so then I thought, wow, is that how we should be using it? Like as a means to really help foster the relationship between you and your clinician or therapist. How are you seeing it manifest in your office right now? Are people coming in with their diagnoses?
So not exactly, because I first of all, I want to say no one will replace an actual therapist ever.
Right.
Because it's the relationship that matters. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are going to turn to AI, of course, but I don't believe there are some therapists kind of freaking out, like, are we going to lose our jobs? And doctors. I don't feel that way. Yeah. And I don't feel that way, because I truly believe at the end of the day, we want someone to profoundly see us, and being in person and deeply connected is the way to do that. That's what's ultimately healing. But I love AI for homework. So when we're running out of time and you know, a patient is talking to me about how they don't know how to approach their sister about not bringing up their weight issue at Thanksgiving. Yeah. If we don't have time to talk about that, I say that's a wonderful thing to talk to AI about. That's a great ChatGPT. Because I do find that a lot of people can talk through dynamics, but finding the actual words is very difficult for people. They really want to be told, you know, what do I say? And of course, that's less of what I'm going to provide. I'm going to talk about what do you want to feel with that person? And, you know, I talk about their goals, but providing them actual language, I'm like, you don't need me for that. So please go use it, you know, in between. Yeah. So I suggest it sometimes to people, never as a replacement, but as a way to continue their work in between psychotherapy sessions or sex therapy sessions.
Right. Really to give them the words they need to really, you know, get to that next level. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, speaking of some technology, I was just thinking of other. Have you seen the show Shrinking?
Yes.
What do you think about it as a therapist?
I mean, look, there's not one show, you know, TV, movie that ever gets it really right.
Right.
But is it absolutely hysterical? And do I love it? 100%.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so outrageous. It's just so outrageous.
It's anatomy of, you know, whatever. Because it, they have some outrageous things that they're doing, and you're like, no, we don't do that. And
it
actually captures a lot, and I can't watch it because of the trauma that I get when watching it.
Very few times while I'm watching Shrinking, I'm like, yeah, I've said that. You know, that kind of never happens.
Yeah.
A lot of it is, you know, very cringy with with the therapist with the worst boundaries ever. But here's what I do like about it. What I do like is that it really shows therapists being human.
Yeah.
And I think that matters.
Yeah.
And this is something I feel pretty deeply. Mm-hmm. I was trained as a psychodynamic psychotherapist, which is very much blank slate, create tons of space, silence, distance, don't share one thing about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, I always say the psychodynamic police is probably like on my shoulder being like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah.
And what I would say is I'm being authentically myself. So I model to my patients how to be authentically themselves.
Yeah.
And they want real in front of them. And I'm sure you relate.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of like even just being out there on social media, showing an authentic side of yourself. I was actually having this conversation with one of my research colleagues, and you know, Dr. Janine Anderson. She was at Ishwish, and she's a great sex therapist researcher. We were talking about reflexivity in medicine, and she was saying, you know, like, we always have to remember, what part of ourselves do we bring into that exam room? Are you just Dr. Rahman, OBGYN, but you're putting aside mom of three, but you're putting aside Muslim woman, you know, that kind of thing. But I think it's the layers that get peeled away as we talk about being on social media and showing people that we're like human beings with issues, you know, like just like anyone else.
Yeah, because if they only put us on a pedestal, that is not useful to them, because then they just continue to see that there's a big distance. And there isn't. There's no distance other than I am here 100% for you right now.
Right, right.
But when I go to my, you know, when I go to my life, you know, it ain't always pretty.
Yeah. You know what? The part I did like about shrinking, I lost my mom a year ago. And so,
Sorry.
And so I liked the 10 minute or the, was it 15 minutes crying? What are you listening to? Some really emotional songs. I did that a lot and I didn't even realize I was doing it. Like, I would listen to her like classic Indian Punjabi songs, and I would sit in the shower and I would cry. I would give myself 10 to 15 minutes almost daily for a very long time. And I come out like, okay, I'm done with that for the day, you know?
Good for you. Yeah. So you're talking about basically honoring all feelings that come up, but putting a nice container around them so that they do not bleed out everywhere. Mm-hmm. And what most people do is stuff them. And then they literally come out at the worst moments in the worst ways. Right. So I 100% support that. And I think that's really wonderful that you did it that way. And you probably got through the acute phase of your grief in a pretty rapid way by honoring what was already there, so that then when you needed to compartmentalize, you could actually do that.
Yeah. It's a big, for experiencing a loss, like, grief isn't linear. It's not like, oh, I'm done with grief. Like, every day it could come up and I have to suppress it. Just to think like, okay, I have to continue to be present for the people who need me, kind of thing. Let's talk about different therapies. I know I went on a tangent because I was just thinking about shrinking in my head. But let's talk about different therapies that are being used right now. I think, you know, I've heard and, you know, done some research on EMDR, but what you're providing is something even more interesting and possibly more effective, you know, depending on the patient. Can you talk to us a little bit about an ART and sort of trauma and how you do, and what it is and how you do it, really?
Sure. So ART or ART is a brief treatment modality that uses rapid eye movement and voluntary image replacement to change the way the brain stores distressing images, memories, and then the corresponding negative sensations that show up in the body when you're triggered. Mm-hmm. And so it does come out of EMDR. It's newer. So it was created by Lainey Rosenzweig in 2008. So it has not been around as long. But in only 1 to 5 sessions, you can experience profound, profound change. And sometimes in as few as 1 session, and you won't need more. So it is incredibly rapid. It is based 100% on science. But what happens in my therapy office is literally pure magic. I have to fight back tears, certainly weekly, if not daily, when I'm doing ART, because you literally see someone change in a way that, you know, I'm a long-term talk therapist. Change is slow. And so it's both gratifying to me as a therapist, but also, again, I'm changing lives. ART is changing lives rapidly. It's a terrible business model because people get better very fast. And sometimes you only work with them for a couple weeks and then they're gone. And of course, obviously that's wonderful. But I always joke, it's not the best, you know, business model.
More people in a shorter amount of time. Well, can you give me an example? As I'm trying to figure it out in my head, like, If I were your client right now, like, talk to me of how you would talk to someone, and we don't have to do a session, obviously, but
yeah, of course.
Like,
Yeah. So what I would say is, let's say you, let's keep it in the sexual realm, you know. So let's say that you had a sexual trauma in college.
Mm-hmm.
And what was showing up for you right now is that when...
We should probably give a trigger warning or something.
Oh, yes. We are going to talk about trauma. I'm not going to give any details that I believe would be triggering actually at all, other than talking about the topic of sexual assault.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. And so you would come in, and let's say that you, every time your husband touched you, you flinched and you got very rigid.
Mm-hmm.
And that along with that meant that you were having sexual pain during intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to come in a lot of current distress. It's causing problems in your marriage. Your husband feels rejected. You feel terrible because you love your husband deeply. But no matter what you do, your body has an automatic response. And you know, because you know it's from the sexual trauma, because you flash there. It feels like that same thing is happening to your body in the moment. So I would say, let's have you come in and let's do some ART to try to get rid of that. What you would do is you'd come in, and again, the idea is that you would see that sexual assault in your mind with zero talking. So what is great about ART is you don't have to talk about your trauma, because what we know is talking about your trauma over and over again actually makes it worse, mm-hmm. in terms of the neural pathways that just keep getting kind of dug in, I like to say. Yeah. And so we're going to create new neural pathways by having a different experience. And so you'll imagine that scene while you're doing this rapid eye movement, which is simply moving your eyes back and forth, left to right.
Closed, or your eyes are open?
So in ART, we do it eyes open. And just not your head. You don't move your head. So you just move your eyes kind of back and forth like this.
Okay.
Now, we're trained to use our hand.
Mm-hmm.
I want to save my shoulder. And so I use a light bar. Many people use a light bar like EMDR therapists do. And you would just follow that while you're thinking about something. When you're thinking about a sexual assault, we would imagine that you're going to have negative sensations show up in your body.
Sure.
The eye movements calm those negative sensations. And so over time, when you pair negative images with negative sensations that then get calmed, you will begin to desensitize yourself to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we basically have you see it again. And the second time you see it, it's often just kind of different, less impactful. You may have more neutral sensations in your body. And then we do this thing called voluntary image replacement, which is, again, where you decide how you wish that had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you wish you had pummeled the guy who was about to sexually assault you and it never happened.
Yeah.
Maybe you wish you had not gone to that fraternity party that night. Exactly. Maybe you wish you'd just gone out with your girlfriends and had a good night. Maybe you wish the police had come. Maybe you wish your father had come and protected you. It's whatever you need to heal that you need to give yourself the experience of seeing. And when you do that, positive sensations show up in your body. And then we spread those all around. The brain doesn't need the truth. It needs a good story that's detailed and healing. And then the brain has no need for the images. So in ART, we say, keep the knowledge, lose the pain. You will never forget the facts. You do not want to forget the facts of your life. But you have no need for the intrusive memories, feelings, or God forbid, getting triggered by your husband in the moment when he just wants to give you a hug. And so it gets rid of current distress by going and healing images from the past. And it works on everything you would go to regular therapy for.
Okay,
everything.
That was my next question I was going to ask you, because I take care of a lot of patients who have provoked vestibulodynia, sexual pain on entry. And many times they've they're born with too many nerve endings at the vulvar vestibule. We call that congenital neuroproliferative vasculopenia. And so these patients really end up needing a vestibulectomy. So we remove that part of the vestibule, you know. And then afterwards, I find that, like, they haven't convinced their body that the pain is gone, even though when I touch them on exam, it's 0 out of 10. And so a lot of times I do recommend EMDR for them and, you know, really, you know, they need physical therapy, pelvic floor therapy, and then some really rigorous therapy to help their brain understand that this is gone now. But have you done this with some of those patients, or do you imagine it working even better than EMDR?
Again, I'm not an EMDR therapist, but mm-hmm. I do know that it does work faster than EMDR for sure. In only 1 to 5 sessions, EMDR is usually a little bit longer. And I have the experience of working with tons of people who've done EMDR and found it somewhat helpful. And then they come and do ART and, you know, they get better. But yes, pelvic pain is, I don't want to say exciting to me. That's not exactly what I mean, but working with it is. So I'll give you an example. I had a patient who came in with 6 years of pelvic pain. She could only get the tip of her fingernail into her vagina and she wanted to become pregnant. Mm-hmm. And she could barely sit. She could barely wear pants. It was completely debilitating. This is a referral from our good friend, Dr. Rachel Rubin, who refers mm-hmm. lots of people to me. Yeah. Who have a lot of difficulties.
You're in Maryland, right?
Yeah, we're about 5 minutes down the road from each other, which is great. And so she came in and we first just, you know, tried to figure out kind of where it came from. And, you know, we did like 1 or 2 sessions and we weren't having a lot of luck. Then I asked her to tune into her pelvic pain in the moment. Mm-hmm. And she could say, you know, these are the sensations in my pelvic floor. It's gripping. It's tight. It feels hot. Mm-hmm. I asked her to ask her brain to show her the first time she had those sensations in her life. I didn't say, when was the first time you had painful intercourse? When was the first time your, you know, vagina hurt, your vulva hurt? Mm-hmm. I said, ask your brain to show you. And immediately her brain showed her being beaten by her mother at the age of 8. That
she had just pushed that away.
She didn't really process it as anything negative. She had just processed it as, this is what my mom did to me.
Yeah.
But what we learned is that the body had linked those two things together. So what happened? To protect herself at age 8, she gripped that pelvic floor as tight as she could to guard. She remembers shielding herself. Well, what happens when you are literally shielding yourself? You're tensing every single thing inside your body, including your pelvic floor. Yeah. So to stay safe, her body protected her in that moment by getting small and tight. But then she continued to do that. And when I tell you this woman's pelvic pain went away, I cannot talk about ART without the goosebumps.
I'm really getting goosebumps myself.
I mean, I literally wish you could see. It's pathetic. It's literally pathetic that I can't talk about it.
I'm feeling so, like, wow right now. Wow.
And I feel emotional. And yeah. She was able to get pregnant by using a turkey baster. So a little bit larger than her pinky, was able to get in there and she got pregnant. So it's really profound work. Sorry.
No, I'm actually about to go too.
It's really wonderful that we can do this so quickly.
Wow. And can you just tell me how do you differentiate EMDR from ART? Like,
sure. Yeah. So there are a few major differences. One is that EMDR deals with thoughts and feelings, mm-hmm. whereas ART deals with images and sensations. So you're actually just, now it doesn't mean that ART can't work on limiting beliefs. It yeah. works incredibly well on things like, you know, I'm not good enough and, you know, I'm ugly and I'm useless and I fail at everything. So it does work on that, but it goes about it through imagery.
Yeah.
And it is, again, as I said, briefer, 1 to 5 sessions per issue versus EMDR, which is usually 10 to 20. It also, EMDR kind of meanders and you follow wherever the patient is going. ART has a very clear protocol. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you don't end a session without resolution. That's why it's called accelerated resolution therapy. Whereas EMDR, people talk about, it kind of opens you up sometimes, and then it doesn't close you back down in a contained way.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of, this is to be continued. And I find that there are a lot of people who cannot manage that distress in between sessions. There's almost no distress in between sessions. In fact, people report feeling much better because we gauge what they feel at the beginning on a scale of 0 to 10. A lot of people, if it's a real huge trauma, are starting at a 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they get to a 0. You know, not everyone. I mean, there's not one treatment that works for everyone. But mm-hmm. there's, it's almost never that someone would feel worse. And in regular trauma therapy, sometimes in EMDR, they feel worse. And guess what? It's not motivating to come back.
Some patients are like, tried it and, you know, It just didn't do it for me or whatever. And so I think that's really helpful to know. And is there a way for people to find who does ART versus, like, is there a site for ART certified?
Yes. So we're growing. It's very exciting. More and more people are getting trained. And I now have a practice that specializes in ART. And it's the greatest thing because we can help so many more people now. And that brings me great joy. But yes, they can go to acceleratedresolutiontherapy.com. And there's a list of people by state, by country. It is in a few countries. It's definitely, there's more in the US and Canada than anywhere else. But yeah, you can find somebody. I have a provider who can do it virtually. That's the other thing. Yeah. It can be, it's equally effective virtually or in person, which shocked me.
Yeah,
absolutely
is.
Shocked me. Yeah. But I have worked with people with profound trauma and virtually, and they do great.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, because we see, you know, like coming up in so many different ways. Like, you know, I'm sure I'm thinking of some patients that I have that have persistent genital arousal disorder who probably started because, you know, when they can remember a time when they were 5 or 6 and they were doing that, to me, that says it's probably region 5 that started it, unless they had a fall or something. And so we kind of do this region-based approach to assessing it. Have you had much experience in that capacity at all with PGAD patients? I'm sure Rachel maybe sent you some patients.
Well, I have experience a lot of people or with some, you know, like chronic UTIs, you know, something like that where, I mean, and they have to process the trauma from when it first started. And it's usually when they're quite little. Mm-hmm. And then you have to sort of work on maybe the first time it occurred that they remembered. But then usually there's the medical gaslighting and you've got to process that. And that's really, so I do work an unbelievable amount with medical trauma.
I was going to ask you that too, because between obstetric trauma that, you know, we have no control over sometime, and medical trauma from the way our system is set up to give people a 10-minute visit and discard their pelvic pain or sexual pain or whatever, I can imagine that's a huge factor.
Yeah, and it works really well with, you know, chronic illness. I mean, you've got, you know, a lot of people with EDS or POTS who've been told it's all in your brain, and they have to work through that to begin to trust their own experience, that this is real and true for them, which we certainly know it is.
Yeah.
And I do, I have, there's one experience of medical trauma that I found was sort of profound is that, well, it was birth trauma, actually. So Dr. Rubin referred someone to me who had come into her office, and the second she was handed a mirror to look at her genitals, she had a full-blown panic attack, and they had to stop immediately. I mean, there was just absolutely no moving forward. Mm-hmm. And so she referred her to me. I only saw her for 2 sessions. Mm-hmm. We processed a birth trauma that had occurred 11 years before. Mm-hmm. And in 2 sessions, she went back to Dr. Rubin, smiling, happy, relaxed, looking at the mirror, learning about her body. Gone. Absolutely 100% gone. I never saw her again. It was great.
Do you find, like, you know, obviously, you know, if you pay attention around the world, people can be traumatized by things they hear. And so, like, you know, with the whole Epstein files, I find a resurgence of people coming in with pelvic pain when there's a lot of information about, you know, sexual assault or, you know, child trafficking or whatever. I have this memory of when Brett Kavanaugh got, I just remember this big uptick in, like, patients who were like, I didn't even know I had this issue, but my pain is back. And so-and-so happened at 6 years old. Is that, are you seeing some of that? Did you see some of that when, you know, the whole Epstein files came up? And
yes, and Kavanaugh, I mean, both. But yes, with Epstein, you know, people are coming in with more symptoms, you know, and also if things had been dormant, you know, like they'd been kind of healed from something, they'll get, a little uptick in, you know, or simply disgust and helplessness. And we can work through that too. I mean, just because, again, sexual abuse survivors, a lot of what you are trying to help them with is that helplessness. Yeah. And when we see this is happening everywhere all the time, and then, you know, there's no problem somehow.
No accountability.
Right. No accountability, nothing happening. Mm-hmm. Then they're angry. And they begin to feel helpless again. And so we sometimes have to work through that with ART or talk therapy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit. Let's change gears from trauma and talk a little bit about sex therapy generally, you know, like mismatched libido and what people get wrong and right about it. First, tell me what you think the biggest, misconception is around sex therapy.
That's a great question. Well, the worst misconception is, of course, that I'll be doing something sexual with you in my office. And about every quarter, I get one of those phone calls, which you can figure out pretty quickly is that kind of phone call. But, the biggest misconception is that they won't need to do homework.
Yeah, right.
They don't. A lot of people come in and they just think we're going to talk about it. Well, you know, it's an action. Sex is an action. Yeah. Intimacy is an action. So sorry, guys, I'm going to give you homework. And if you don't do it, that's fine. Yeah. But it's not going to change. So I want to, you know, make people understand that most sex therapy involves homework.
Yeah.
Doing it differently.
That's it, guys. Homework is involved. So get back to it.
And the most important homework is always going to be masturbation.
Right.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Sex therapy involves a lot of masturbation for good reasons.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's talk about when you use it and vibrators and stuff. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't, and we should talk a little bit about sensate therapy. So where do you use sensate therapy? Where do you use, you know, directed masturbation or, you know, vibrator, you know, work?
Well, vibrators, yes, early, often, all the time. Please have as many as you want. That's what I would say about
more than that.
Yeah, that's what I would say about vibrators. And I think vibrators are super exciting right now. My favorite is the LEM right now by Hello Nancy. And I have recommended it to all my patients, and they just come back in and they just, you know, kind of give a thumbs up. So that's good. So in terms of homework, for people who come in with a lot of sexual shame and then anorgasmia, that's going to be a lot of masturbation.
Sure.
And again, it will start wherever they are. Sometimes someone will come in, a woman will come in who's anorgasmic and she's never masturbated. She might be in her 40s or 50s. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, she remembers being turned on by something at a young age and then has shame about that. And so therefore has kind of shut her own orgasm down. And so there we're just working on getting very comfortable with your body, but we don't start with genitals. So again, if someone's really kind of phobic, we are going to start with my simple question, which is incredibly difficult for a lot of women to answer. What brings you pleasure?
Yeah, true.
Not sexually.
Just in general.
What? Anything. And I will say it feels very sad to me that many women cannot answer that. And
because
so
we don't think of our pleasure. We just say, okay, you know what? Suffering we can endure. Let's just get through it. Let's help our kids feel good. Let's help our husband feel good. Let's help our wife feel good. Whatever. You know, like it's we don't think about we don't center it, honestly.
That's right. So we'll start there, and then we'll start with totally non-sexual touch, non-erotic touch, you know? And, you know, I find like something as simple as like, do you like your hair played with? Do you like your hair being brushed? And you know what?
Yeah.
Men, women, non-binary people, I guess there's a lot of nerve endings in your scalp because people love that. Mm-hmm. It's also a very loving thing, right? We think about it like a parent would do. It's not necessarily erotic, but it makes people feel very safe, very calm, very held and kind of cherished.
Yeah.
And so that's a great thing to do to yourself or to ask a partner to do if you have one. So, yeah, that's where I do a lot of the masturbation kind of homework.
Yeah.
And then the sensate focus is usually a little bit more with couples.
Yeah.
So couples that come in and they're in a sexless marriages, I see a lot of sexless marriages.
Sexless marriage, by the way?
So, again, I mean, I usually try to just give a general idea that it's usually if you haven't had sex in the last year, and that's kind of continuing maybe. But I think that you get to define it the way you want to define it. I don't believe in strict definitions, but I do think occasionally it can be helpful to people to just understand what we mean by that. And so in those situations or very mismatched libidos or people who have totally non-erotic energy between them, which is a lot of middle-aged couples, let's be real, right? Just, you know, flat. And they love each other and they want to be together and they, you know, find each other even attractive, but they've just lost all the erotic energy. I will have them just go back to basics. And what I usually say is, remember when you were, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, 22, when you first started becoming a sexual being, and making out was the greatest, you know, you could have the most pleasure in the world from that. How many married couples, how many long-term partners are making out? Almost zero. Almost zero.
No, I had a patient tell me just the other day, she's been married for like 20 years and was like, you know, he tried to kiss me and I love him, but oh, I can't stand kissing him anymore. Like his tongue, like, and she said, I used to love it. And she's like, will this testosterone make me want to kiss him again? I was like, wow, it's a little complicated.
Yeah. And there I would say, well, have you told him how you like to be kissed now? Mm-hmm. What you're learning about yourself now?
No.
It is never too late to teach your partner how to touch you.
Yes, that's good. Yeah.
Never. Mm-hmm. And you can say something, you know, people do not want to do this. I don't want to ask. Well, I don't know how you get into anything in life without asking, but that's just me. But so, you know, you got to take control of it. But you can say, you know, I was thinking something that we could do together that would be fun is, why don't you teach me how to kiss you the way you really want to be kissed? So you model it. And what you're really saying, you know, underneath is, oh my God, please, can I teach you how to kiss me? But that's not the point. You do reciprocal. Mm-hmm. And that creates, I mean, because your partner is probably going to go, oh, wow, we haven't kissed at all in a while. Sure. Mm-hmm. But you got to get back to basics. Do you remember when holding hands and just feeling somebody's fingertips, you know, when you're in a movie, when you were younger, felt? Mm-hmm. Do that. That feels good. You got to get those senses activated again. But when you only do, it's 9 o'clock, the kids are in bed, let's have sex, let's start with missionary, then I'm going to turn you over. Yeah, we're going to do it this way. You're not using lube. You expect things to happen. That's just not how it works anymore. And here's the part I don't think people get right. You have to grieve what is lost. You have to grieve the ripping your clothes off, you know, for somebody. you have to grieve that you aren't dying inside to, you know, have sex with your partner. You have to grieve it. It's a loss. And I don't think that gets talked about enough.
That's true, actually. We just assume, I mean, you know, I always talk to my patients about responsive desire and these long-term relationships. And, you know, this medication is not going to make you want to drop down and like, you know, do it 5 times a week or whatever, but you might not push him back as many times, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't think that we talk enough about the loss of the fact that spontaneous desire or horniness is no longer part of the equation.
Yeah. But, or mm-hmm. and, it doesn't mean that you can't start to refocus on how to build and make space for responsive desire. And so there are a lot of ways to do that. And the biggest thing around responsive desire, in my opinion, is the willingness to try. That means I don't feel like it in this moment, but I value our sexual connection. I know I always feel better afterward. I know I always feel more connected to you. I know you're less grumpy. And so I'm willing to try. Does that mean that you have to stay with it if after 20 minutes you're still like, you know, feeling absolutely nothing? No, but give it 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And specifically, the way to do that, that helps with the willingness to try, is to build in a transitional activity from paying bills, screaming at the kids to go to bed, to fine, let's get naked and have sex. People think they can just do that. And again, we aren't that simple. And especially when we're middle age with hormonal shifts and problems and, you know, weight gain, we're not feeling as good, whatever it is. And so you got to build in an activity that can be a 5-minute meditation. That could be taking a bath or a shower, going in and rubbing, you know, your favorite scented lotion all over your body. How do you get back in your body and out of your thinking anxious brain and more into it? I also encourage people, if they're not feeling it, go take your vibrator into your bathroom. If you know you have, let's say, a sexual date with your partner, you know, at 9, go into the bathroom at 8:45 before they come home and masturbate for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You don't need desire to come before arousal. You cannot wait for desire to hit you like a bolt of lightning.
Yeah.
It's not happening.
It's not happening anymore. Well,
for most of us, I don't mean to say that it can't. I think it absolutely can. Yeah. I'm having the best sex of my life at age 51.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that I don't also have to work on the responsive thing. It is 100% a thing. And I'm not in a long-term marriage right now, so I've got that going for me as well, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's an uphill battle. It's not easy.
Yeah.
But you have to work toward acceptance of what is no longer to create what can be.
That's actually a very good point, actually. And I think that's the part that we don't emphasize enough, right? Like this whole idea of like where we go from here, but it's okay. Like it's okay. We can go from here.
Yeah. And also, and then just everybody says, what's wrong with me? I mean, it's just the perpetual what's wrong with me. I must be the only person, you know, who doesn't want to. And also it makes them doubt their love for their partner. Because they're like, wait, I know I love my partner, but I don't want this. What does this say? Maybe not much other than you got to, you know, bring in some mystery, imagination and play.
What? Exactly. Yeah. The date nights are important. Yeah. You know, the other question I had before we go is, you know, I know a lot of, you know, I think I may have talked about this before. My son has OCD. And so, you know, I know a lot of patients that have OCD. They have OCD and PGAD. Do you see ART working in the patients that have OCD when they usually are getting exposure therapy most of the time? And to me, I feel like that's very traumatic. We talked about it offline. Can you tell us how you would approach that? And are you seeing it used in the pediatric population?
Yeah, I'm seeing it used with kids, with adults, and in all sorts of ways, right? OCD can show up in a lot of ways, right? You know, behaviorally.
It's just not excessive hand cleaning. It's sometimes it's like OCD thoughts and harm OCD.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it works on OCD thoughts. It works on OCD intrusive images. And it absolutely works on behaviors, checking behaviors, or, you know, it could hand washing. It really works sort of on all levels. And I'll give you an example. So I have a patient who I actually saw for sexual trauma using ART, and she did beautifully. And what we've done actually is just continued to work together because she just, you know, she has some complex things and mental health issues. And so she, you know, wants to work on different stuff. So she never believed that her OCD would ever change, ever. She thought, this is how, you know, who I am. I have it. And so for a while, she didn't even bring it up. And I was like, yes, of course we can work on that. Mm-hmm. So she had a very specific intrusive image of a little trigger warning, slashing her own legs with a knife. We have no idea why. It would be exactly right. So, and why doesn't matter. And this is important about OCD and a lot of other things. If you've talked about it and it's not changing, the why no longer matters, and you need to figure out how to change your body and your brain. So we did, and it again caused so much distress, distracting. She'd be out to dinner and it would just be over and over. It was happening in my office as we were talking. And so what we did is, again, we had her see the terrible intrusive image of that with the knife. And then I said, you know, what's going on in your body? And she said, you know, I have an incredibly tight chest and my jaw is clenched. And we said, you know, I said to her, when is the first time you had those sensations? And would you know it, but immediately, and again, this is why I love the brain knows exactly where to take you, which you can trust because it pops up like that. She went to the moment that she found a text at age 13, which showed that her father was having an affair. We cleared that memory. We cleared it. We desensitized her to it. We had her replace it with the way she wished it had happened. And she never had an intrusive thought, an image of that again. And again, here I am getting goosebumps for the second time on this podcast. Never again. And she and I have worked through so many different types of OCD checking behaviors, which we realized had to do with not feeling safe in her home after she was sexually assaulted. And so we cleared that. And then she didn't need to check the doors every night. She could just check them once, like a normal person might do before they went to bed.
But let me ask you, like, if someone's dealt with OCD their whole life, and you're checking one of the things that they're OCD at that juncture, is this something that clears and then they have to read? I mean, because that's how I imagine. I imagine, you know, if you have OCD since age 5, like my son, you are not going to get rid of it in your whole life, right? But you can figure out how to deal with it, right? Like how to deal with each new OCD or no? What do you think?
So, well, here's what I would say. Can we get rid of like the OCD brain entirely? I don't think so, at least not yet.
Yeah.
Do I think you can clear specific OCD behaviors for a lifetime? I guess we'll find out. I haven't worked with anyone for a lifetime. I haven't worked with anyone yet for 15 years because a lot of times they don't need to come back. And so I'm not going to be able to track them.
Well, is this something that they learn to do? Like if that one person that you mentioned started having another image of something else, and then you taught her the ART way, like, is that something that she would then, because that's hard. I mean, I don't know. Would she be able to do
that? So here's what we can do. And I do this early with everyone. We can teach them self-administered eye movements. They can't do the whole protocol. They're not therapists. They're not trained to do that.
Right.
But they can learn to do eye movements to move and clear negative sensations. That's what we work on. You can also use eye movements like with positive visualization. So, you know, you can, you could imagine, let's say you have a fear of public speaking. You could imagine yourself bombing your public speaking. Let's say you have it next week. You could see yourself bombing it. And then notice that you've got negative sensations, clear the negative sensations with eye movements, and then replace it with you killing it in a good way at that thing. And then you store that in your brain.
So cool.
It works so well on performance anxiety.
You've sold me. That's awesome. Okay, so are there any people that actually cannot do ART?
So it's a good question. So there are three screening questions to determine if you're a good fit for ART. The first is, can you move your eyes comfortably back and forth? And that really means, you know, not if you have a current concussion or if you have a seizure disorder and you, you know, now some people do actually have seizure disorders and they just clear it with their neurologist first.
Okay.
But I would always recommend doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you actually have something literally wrong with your eyes where it prevents you from doing that.
Sure.
Now, there's a caveat. You still could do bilateral tapping by holding tappers or tapping on your knees. But, you know, ideally it's eye movements.
Mm-hmm.
The second question is, can you hold a thought and an image in your mind? I do find that people who do not think at all in images. I think it's called aphantasia. I'm not great with the word. If you have aphantasia, it can be really challenging to do ART. Not impossible, but challenging because you don't naturally see things in your mind. And, you know, the way to test that is just to say to yourself, you know, can I see what myself having breakfast this morning? And if you can, then you're fine.
Yeah.
See images.
Yeah.
The third screening question is, are you motivated to change? And this is a tricky one. Everyone says, of course, why am I here? What do you think? And they sometimes get kind of pissed at me that I'm asking, like, what do you think I'm calling for? And so I understand that. But here's what we're looking for. If you have a secondary gain in staying stuck, it's not going to work very well. So for instance, and again, I have a chronic illness. I'm not blaming anyone with a chronic illness. There are people with chronic illnesses that identify so strongly with their community that giving up the chronic illness would mean giving up their community, their identity, their place of belonging. So it might be a little more complicated for them. Again, you would just need to know that that's part of what you're bringing in before you start ART.
But this has been wonderful. Please tell everyone, I'll put it in the show notes too. We'll put it in the show notes, but please tell everyone where they can find you, how they can get in touch with you and what you have coming up.
Yeah. So you can find me at brookbraylove.com and Instagram and Facebook is at Brooke Braylove Psychotherapy. And I'm just continuing to build a practice that specializes in sex therapy and ART. And that combination, specifically my passion, the place I feel deepest, is around sexual trauma of any kind and helping people heal with ART so that they can be these beautiful, wonderful sexual beings who feel very deserving of all kinds of pleasure in their lives.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really eye-opening. I am very captivated by everything you said.
Thank you. It was fun to be here.
Yeah. But everyone, thanks for tuning in for another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.